Blog Talk Radio.
From the beautiful mountains of Western North Carolina, just outside the Blue Ridge Parkway, under the stars and around our mysterious blue planet, you are listening to
Shadows of Dark.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Shadows in the Dark. I'm your host, Jeremiah Greer, and what a great show we're going to have tonight. Here in a few minutes, we're going to be welcoming our special guest on, Michael Tesarian. But before we get to that, we do have a few things to get out of the way, and I've got a few news stories I want to share with you. But first off, I want to something I really thought I should be doing. I haven't been in the past, but I want to welcome a few new members to our forum, and if you aren't aware, we do have a forum, and you're more than welcome to sign up to it. It is free. Just go to www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com and click on the link that says forum. But I want to welcome Don from New Jersey and Glenda from Oklahoma and say thank you so much for supporting the show and becoming a member of the forum. You know, it's a small forum, but it's growing. We just opened it up just a few months ago, so maybe about 3 months ago or so. And we hope that anyone out there listening will take the time to join us, and you can continue discussing any show that we have on here or any kind of topics within the paranormal, the metaphysical, the strange, the weird, conspiracies, the whole nine yards. So if you get the chance, go check it out. A lot of great things going on here at the show besides the forum as well. And if you're out there listening live and you want to join us in the chat room, you are more than welcome to. You can get to it two ways. You can go right here on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com/shadowsinthedark, or just go over to our website and click on the link that says join us in the chat. So we'd like to have you in the chat room where you can participate, ask questions, take part in the show. We always encourage our listeners to be a part of the show, so make sure and do that if you'd like. So, well, let's get to a little bit of news here. Got some great stories here. One of these stories I'm actually was going to do last show, and I just thought it was a great story that I still had to do it, so let's get it in there. So it seems that a judge is allowing a $2 billion lawsuit claiming mind control to continue on. So a judge has refused to dismiss a civil lawsuit brought by a British Columbia man who is seeking $2 billion in damages from Microsoft, TELUS, Walmart, the RCMP, and other defendants over alleged brainwave control, satanic rituals, and witchcraft. Justice Fraser Wilson heard from five lawyers on Monday who argued that the case brought forward by Jerry Rose is so outrageous it should be dismissed. Mr. Rose's claims say he has been subject to invasive brain-computer interface technology, research experiments, field studies, and surgery, and also names the University of British Columbia and British Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons as defendants. Jennifer Milbank, the lawyer hired to represent Microsoft in the case, said that Mr. Rose's two-page statement of claim is nothing short of bizarre, and that it would be impossible this would ever be a case for trial on the merits. But Judge Wilson, while admitting that the case was certainly an unusual one, said he had to be convinced that there was nothing in Mr. Rose's claim that could be litigated. Mr. Rose said he was asking for $2 billion because of a computer technology he invented that was stolen from him. I'm not a lawyer, but I have proof, Mr. Rose says. So that's an interesting. How about this one right here? Now, if you're a Beatles fan, and I enjoy the Beatles, even though I am young, I still enjoy the Beatles. I think it is one of those timeless music. I'm a music lover myself, so I really enjoyed this story. So it seems that a lost Beatle track recorded in 1967 and performed just once in public could finally be released, according to Paul McCartney. The song is called Carnival of Light. It's a 14-minute experimental track recorded at the height of the Beatles' music experimentations with psychedelia. and has long been considered too adventurous for mainstream audience. In an interview for BBC Radio, McCartney said that his bandmates and their producer, George Martin, had vetoed its inclusion on the 1990s anthology collection. Now, McCartney confirmed he still owned the master tapes, adding that he suspected the time has come for its great moment. The improvised work features distorted electric guitars, discordant sound effects, a church organ, and gargling interspersed with McCartney and John Lennon shouting random phrases like Barcelona and Are You All Right? McCartney would need to consent with Lennon's widow, Yoko Ono, and George Harrison's widow, Olivia Harrison, to release the track. So if you're a Beatles fan, look forward to that. Hopefully the permission will come, and we'll hear the Carnival of Life, 14-minute track, so should be interesting. Now, our last bit of news here is coming out of India. Maybe some of you have been following this story where India launched a TV-size probe towards the moon. So this TV-size probe with the painting of the Indian flag successfully rammed into the moon Friday evening as part of the country's first unmanned lunar mission. The moon impact probe detached from the unmanned lunar orbiter and made a hard landing on the lunar surface around 8:31 p.m. New Delhi time, which is 10:01 Eastern time. So that's a little bit of some of the news for us right now. And well, like I said, we're going to get ready to welcome our special guest on, and that's going to be Michael Tesori. And if you're out there listening live, more than welcome to join us in the chat room. It's definitely already starting to fill up there, and we want to see as many people crammed in there as possible. I would like an eye. I just can't follow the chat. That would be kind of cool. And that has happened a few times, and we'd like to see it every night. So let's take a quick little break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Michael Tesori.
Want more from Shadows in the Dark? Visit our website and sign up for our free newsletter. Become a member in our forum and check out our online store. Just visit www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com, where the darkness is illuminated.
In Northern Ireland, Michael Tesori is an expert on the occult histories of Ireland and America. He has made the deepest researches into Atlantis, the origins of evil, and into the Irish origins of civilizations. Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Jeremiah. It's nice to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on, and I have to say, I've been a fan of yours. I've heard you on many other shows where you've been a regular on, and I'm an avid Coast to Coast listener, so I know I've heard you on there many times. And it seems many in the chat room are fans of yours as well, kind of following you around there, so that's wonderful. You just have so many fascinating topics, and it is such a pleasure to have you on. Now, for those who may not know who you are, can you give a little bit of biography of yourself? I read briefly, but a little bit more for us.
Well, sure. Yeah, I live in America now, but originally started my studies in Ireland. And as you rightly said in the introduction, you know, started looking into the secret societies that operate in the Irish context, the Northern Ireland, Southern Ireland, you know, and that was one of the important threads that got me to realize, you know, that there's something going on a worldwide level that, you know, is hidden from us. Finally last year when I brought up my book on the Irish origins of civilization, it was basically the conclusion of studies that I began, you know, around the early 80s, basically. Mm-hmm. And that included many different things. And then when I moved to America, you know, after the after researching things in Ireland, then I slowly, through the late 80s and into the 90s, then started to realize that the same sort of the secret societies are operating, you know, in an American context, and then began writing on that, and also was invited to do some conferences. First, I was just more like a, you know, hanging around with Jordan Maxwell, who's one of my mentors, and he basically was promoting me a lot, so it wasn't intentional that I do anything in the public eye, but there was a lot of support, actually, for the first book that I wrote on Atlantis, and in the community, in Bay Area specifically, and people there like Brian Hall and Victoria Jack and others, also from Washington, you know, started to invite me to do conferences based on Jordan's, you know, promotion of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, that was a bit of a challenge, you know. It was.
Well, I'm just saying, not bad having Jordan Maxwell backing you up, though.
No, you know, it was a surprise. It was kind of. It's funny that most of my mentors, the ones that I've known personally, have done that. They've sort of pushed me out into the limelight, you know, because, you know, I have done contributions for David Icke and, you know, contributed and worked with Jordan and others, but it never had, in fact, quite the contrary. I was not somebody that wanted to, you know, work in the public eye in that way at all. It eventually happened, but as I said, from all the way through the 80s and the 90s, these were just studies, as they are for many people. I'm sure it's your listeners are the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a tremendous interest. I wouldn't call it a hobby. I would call it a lot more than that. But, you know, publishing books and doing, you know, documentary films and all of this kind of thing and public talks never, ever, you know, was something I ever planned to do. Just, you know, some people say that, you know, accident, fate, whatever,
right.
You know, or like I said, you know, it was just being very welcomed by people that I actually considered mentors, you know, and I used to go to these conferences or go with like a chaperone with Jordan. You know, these were people I was meeting who were, you know, pretty much mentors, you know, and heroes of mine, like, you know, Eustace Mullins and Geoward Griffin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you sit down and talk with these people, and, you know, they were very complimentary about what I was doing. And at that time, I had the Atlantis book, was just about out. I think it was 2002 that actually, you know, put it out in the public. And even Richard Hoagland, and, you know, basically all the team of the people that are, you know, pushing the envelope in this area, they had thought, Jeremiah, that, you know, there was not enough younger people involved in this subject matter. They knew that there was a lot of interest from younger people, but they hadn't seen anybody on the podium, on the stage, you know, who could actually, from the younger generation, come and sort of bring some new blood, some new interest into this.
Right.
And they were, that's why they were so anxious, you know, for somebody like me to, you know, go the next step forward and start doing public talks, because they wanted that, you know, because at the time, I think it was only myself and John Greenwald from BlackVault.com, you know, maybe only two of us of this sort of, you know, in our 30s, you know, early 30s and mid-30s doing this kind of work. So the feeling there was, you know, let's have some new blood, and then also that might attract, you know, the youth to come to these conferences and to get into this material. And, of course, it was helped a lot by 9/11. I mean, it sounds horrible to say that, but actually I recall one of the big conferences that we did on September 15th, can you believe it, of 2001, which is just literally days after the tragedy.
Yeah.
And, yeah, even though that was a tragedy, one of the upsides of it was that was the first conference that we did in the Bay Area. And these are pretty large conferences, but at this time, all of us noticed that it was just chock-a-block with younger kids, and many of them even had cameras and video recorders, and they wanted to interview us, and they were, you know, they were attending, they were there, they were paying to listen to the talks. So it's sad to say that you know, the tragedy shook people up, but one of the good sides of it was that it immediately we saw a lot of new younger people coming in, you know, to hear what the speakers had to say, and that was a very good feeling in a way, you know.
Yeah, most definitely, and I agree. I mean, it's, you know, it's important that the younger generation gets involved, and I'm only 30 myself. Out here kind of doing this thing. Now, I don't go to conferences, but twice a week we broadcast the show, and we seem to have a younger audience, so you can, you know, definitely see that, you know, the younger generation getting a lot more involved as the years, you know, keep going, and it's great. It's an important thing, and, you know, John Greenwald, he's great. We're actually on their network as well.
Right.
So he's great. He's been on the show. Now, you mentioned Brian Hall. Now, is this the Brian Hall from Conspiracy Con?
Yeah, exactly. This is about his eighth year.
Yes.
You know, and I was there from the very beginning, you know, and Robert Perala, who's usually his maitre d', and Jordan and Victoria Jacka and that whole team of people, and also the, you know, the people that they have running the conferences who volunteer, people like Paul, you know, Mitchell and others who are just, you know, work their asses off there, and Patrick Bailey, you know, who does the sound, and just the whole team, you know, they had their own progress. Starting from scratch was difficult for them, and then, you know, it was so great for them to be able to continue that project once a year in the Bay Area UFO Expo. So this crowd, you know, that I was kind of outside looking in, you know, but they really encouraged me to continue the book and to turn up at their conferences, even if I wasn't going to speak, because I'm very hesitant to speak on the same thing twice. So I didn't want to attend every year. You know, I would only attend and speak if I had absolutely new subject matter. And, you know, they were okay with that. But basically what happened was that they just, you know, said, look, you're going to come, even if you're just coming to the vendor room or if you just come as a guest, you know, just be part of our family, basically. And it was just wonderful to me, you know, meeting my heroes like Ted Grinderson and Jim Mars, you know, and Eustace Mullins, G. Edward Griffin, the big names, you know. And then also, as I said, to see these younger guys, some of them from the Army, just even people from, you know, ordinary life, which we don't see in Europe. You see, America is much more ahead that way, in which, first of all, you have more people who are into the subject matter. Then we said more young. And you don't see this in Europe. You don't see this throughout the rest of the world, where there's much more hesitancy. There's much more sort of, you know, cynicism in a way. And there's less proactive, you know, steps being taken by people to say, look, I want to find out. You know, it's more in America and Canada and the Americas than it is in Europe, you know, which is kind of sad, but that's the way it is right now.
Yeah, and, you know, we had Brian Hall. We did a 24-hour broadcast to celebrate our year anniversary this past April, and we had Brian on. And man, that guy has so much passion. It was just something else listening to him. He was on for an hour, and he was just a mile a minute, you know, just talking.
Yeah.
And he would just blew everybody away, just the passion that he had and the way that he presented, you know, himself. It was just a wonderful interview to hear him. And maybe one of these years I'll get out there to his conference. I would definitely like to check that out.
Really, it's a really, really cool event. I mean, he's a really good friend. I've stayed at their house and I agree with you. He is very passionate, you see, because I think it was my second or third talk where I was invited to come, and I said that, look, you know, I don't really have a talk on 9/11. Others are doing that. I've done my talk on Atlantis. You know, we've done that, Brian. You know, my next thing would be to do something on the subversive use of sacred symbolism. And, you know, I was thinking, okay, he's not going to be into this because it's a little bit off. You know, it's going to be different. I'm going to have to hard sell this to him. And he actually thought about it for about 6 months. He said, send me the information on what it's about, and I'll think about it. And do you know that about, you know, 4 months later, he actually invited me to do that talk. So I owe him that. You know, that talk was subsequently uploaded to Google, and it was very successful. I get emails almost every day because of it. And it was him believing in that. It was him, you know, having the scope to say, wait a minute, you know, maybe this is important about symbolism, about, subliminal aspect, this other type of psychic dictatorship, you know. It wasn't quite the normal thing that you'd been seeing at Conspiracy Con in the past. Mm-hmm. And he really believed in the thesis, and it was so great for me. That was one of my best times there, and it was a good talk, and he believed in it. So, again, you know, kudos to him for that, because a lot of people said, oh, no, we have to keep on the same old line here, you know, let's just keep on bashing 9/11 or bashing, you know, JFK or, you know, some other element of the conspiracy, which is sort of done already, you know, let's bring something new in. So, you know, he was really open to that, and has still been, even to other things.
Wow. Well, I tell you what, let's get into your work, and let's talk about what exactly you have been working on. Now, I know a lot of tonight we're going to talk some about astrotheology, and can you tell us exactly what that is?
Well, astrotheology, from an American context, and I know you're a fan of Coast to Coast, so you'll probably have caught my show with Jordan. Jordan Maxwell is the man who really, in an American context within the last 40 years, has brought that subject to the fore, in the sense that it's a story of history, but it also impacts, you see, our world today. Basically, it's a story of tyranny. It's a story of control. but it focuses more on where the modern religions and where the sort of governmental systems and even the media, what is the archive that they're all dipping into? Because there is an archive there. If we look at even the designs of the cities, if we look at the symbolism that's being used, even some of the rhetoric that's being used, and certainly when you get into like looking at the symbols of flags and the symbols of heraldry and the symbols of government, mm-hmm. and many of the corporations, including the technical corporations, you will see the sun, you will see the pentagram, you will see the stars, you will see the crescent moon, you know, like on Kodak, right. and on like a you know, American Online and so on. So there's a sort of a symbolistic, there's a symbolism out there that people just say, oh, well, you know, that's just being pulled randomly. These are interesting symbols, you know, and Madison Avenue or these designers, they just pick and choose what's going on here. But Jordan had worked for years, you see, to show that, no, these people are using these symbols because many of these people, and to be specific, that means the people who are at the highest level of the corporate ownership. This means the venture capitalists who actually have paid for most of the corporations to exist, those ones you don't see these venture capitalists, you just see the Bill Gateses and the, you know, Steve Jobs and the people that they like to put out front,
right.
as if they're the owners. But in fact, in most cases, these people own pretty much only about 2.5% of the businesses that they front. So you're talking venture capitalists here, and then you're talking about the elite of Madison Avenue. And when you really dip into the subject, you find out that many of these people are members of fraternities. They're members of secret societies like the Freemasons and so on. And therefore, they use all of this symbolism because, you know, they're Masons. These are symbols that are beloved to them.
Right.
It's not that the symbols are negative or anything like that. It's just that, you know, this is the network, this is the club. And therefore, when they open a corporation or when they establish a new edifice or institution or whatever, you know, you're going to find the murals and you're going to find the symbolism, just in the same way that the British government and the royal dynasties of Europe, when they decided to have an emblem or an insignia, they did the same thing. They put the symbols on it that were the ancient symbols of their lineage, the symbols of their secret societies. And this can be proven by looking at the medals and the adornments and the insignias and the state emblems, you see. But then to get into the astrotheology is to go even deeper. Because once you've realized that, okay, there's something going on here and you track it back to these so-called secret societies that operate throughout the world, well, then where do you go? You know, why would they be interested in this? Do these symbols have power? Where do they actually come from? So then you go even a little bit more deeper, you see, and then you find out that this goes back to the ancient cults of the ancient world that Jordan has spoken on, things like the solar cult and the stellar cult. And of course, this has now been picked up and is becoming a little bit fashionable. You know, you have the Zeitgeists,
right.
and you have other little shows which are good in themselves. They're sort of dipping into this and people looking into the concept that, for instance, the Jesus of the Bible, you see, and Muhammad and Zoroaster, and some of the great heroic figures of the past, they tend to have the solar symbolism around them. Or say the Mother Mary, you see, has the stellar symbol, where they talk in the Bible about, you know, her crown being of 12 stars and the crescent moon beneath her feet.
Hmm.
And in the book of Revelations, you find, you know, the talk of the seven-headed dragon, you know, which of course ties into Hydra. These are constellations. And so what Jordan and the men who studied astrotheology hundreds of years ago that my work is specifically dedicated to, people like Gerald Massey and so on, these are people who basically were able to interpret the Bible, and not just the Bible, but also other scriptures, things like the Gnostic Gospels, things like the Apocrypha, things like the work of the Sibylline Oracles or what have you. So it's not just the Bible, it's lots and lots of different scriptures throughout the world. So suddenly you can start to use astrotheology as what's called a hermeneutic to analyze and to interpret what these passages really mean. It's a kind of language, a hidden secret hermetic language. And astrotheology is the doorway, you see, into that hidden language that, yes, it's used by secret societies, but they don't own it. This is knowledge that was once taught by the great elders of the world for the uplift of all mankind. Doesn't matter if you were a Gothic or a Nordic or a Brahmin, you see, or an Egyptian or a Celt or a Gael, or a Native American Indian, you know. This was the lexicon, the archive of knowledge that was there to attune man to the universe in which he lives. The secret societies and the royals, you see, sequestered this kind of information and use it for their own empowerment. So the work of astrotheology is to dip into what the subject is and really look at that, and also sort of, basically reclaim it in a way. so that the whole human race can do two things. One, they can understand how important this knowledge is for their own spiritual traditions. And two, they can then develop a sort of an immunity so that when these symbols are being used in a negative way, you know, you're prepped and prepared. And I talked about this in the Subversive Symbolism DVD, and the talk I did at ConspiracyCon is that it's twofold. It's about knowing and empowering yourself with this knowledge, but at the same time developing an immunity so that when, you know these sort of hidden elect are using it against you, you know, you're not so, you know, controlled by this symbolism, because there's a lot of power in these ancient symbols. The stars were originally the symbol of God. So was the sun. You know, the zodiac. These things are very, very powerful.
Wow. Now, we've already got a few questions coming through the chat room. I'm going to jot some of them down before we really get to them. Now, you have got some excerpts from your book, Astrotheology, and you had mentioned four great cults being the basis of Christianity. Now, can you explain that and what these four great cults, at least, you said at least four great cults.
Exactly, at least. There's up to seven.
Uh-huh.
In the DVD I did on the same subject, there's at least a mention of about seven different cults there. You know, the fire cult, the cult of Dionysus, the Venusian cult. You know, and of course, don't forget that you have these seven cults and then the four great ones. But then you have modifications of each of those cults depending upon what nation you're talking about. So these are worldwide global institutions. And as I'm implying, they haven't really gone away. But even leaving that aside, these great cults or churches of the ancient world, they were slightly different depending on whether you were Solar Cult of Babylon, Solar Cult of Sumeria, Solar Cult of, you know, Hindustan, Solar Cult of Ireland, or Solar Cult of Egypt, Solar Cult of the Mexicos. There'll be some common symbolism used, like the symbol of the serpent and the symbol of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
But then it'll be modified somewhat, you know, based again on the traditions that you come from. And this is part of the reason why people haven't picked up on the existence of these cults before. But you see, absolutely, the whole of Christianity, the rising of their sun king, which is Jesus, you know, Jesus himself being based on Isus, which is an old Irish god, which the Greeks picked up as I believe it's Bacchus, and the Romans as Dionysus. I may have that wrong. It's late now, so I may get some stuff muddled here.
That's all right.
Dionysus and even Zeus, you see. And Orpheus and Bacchus, these are all, you know, versions of a central earth spirit god, a very, very, very primordial god that the Eastern people have as Ishwara, or the Shiva, you see. And out of that, then the Christians, you know, picked up with their Jesus and many of the other characters as well. You know, many of the images that we are familiar with. You know, Joseph of the coat of many colors, or, you know, John the Baptist and the whole part of him getting his head severed, which is, again, directly linked to astrotheology. In the book that I did on astrotheology in June, it came out in about July, I think. You know, we go into almost, well, not every story of the Bible, of course, but the very, very famous ones, the very familiar ones, numerous stories about the Bible from the point of the nativity, the visitation of the three shepherds, the, you know, the all sorts of things, the crucifixion, the coming of the 12, you know, the meanings of the different disciples and their names. I go into all of this in the book to show, from, you know, not to bash Christianity or anything like that, but to show the alternative story, to say, here's the astrotheological interpretation, here's the astrological, you know, interpretation of why these incredible things are spoken of in the Bible, why Jesus rode, you know, an ass into the city of Jerusalem, why he spoke on a mount, for instance, what the symbolism, you know, of the five loaves and the two fishes are. I see many people have dabbled in this, and many people, you know, have had a spin on all of these kinds of things, but it really comes to life. It really can be corroborated when you get into the astrotheology of it, because that is the subject of all subjects. That's the one that really digs in deep and answers these incredible story, you know, the incredible anecdotes of the Bible, both of the Old and the New Testament.
And you list some Bible passages and in some of the excerpts that I read. Now, do you mind going through just a few of them and the symbolism behind them?
Well, one of the interesting things, and it's in the first chapter of the Astrotheology book, it's like a few pages in,
mm-hmm.
It's just the amount of zodiacal and Yeah, basically astrological symbolism. Whether it is reference to the stars directly, and you know, as you can see from the excerpts, there are many direct references to the stars, to the eastern horizon, to the rising of the sun, and so on. Or if it's more vague, in the sense of, say, for instance, Moses at the burning bush. Why didn't he meet him at a mountain? Why didn't he meet him at a well? Why didn't he meet him in a valley? Why didn't he, you know, why a burning bush of all things? It's such a striking motif. It's such a striking image of the burning tree. You know, do any of us remember or know that that is a symbol, you know, coming out of Ireland, of the burning tree that ties into the whole mythos of the Kabbalah, which is often described like that, you see? There's lots of interesting aspects there. Why is Christ crucified on a hill, a hill that's known as Skull Hill or Golgotha? You know, what are the four letters above Jesus' name, you know, when he's on the cross, the I-N-R-I? So all of these things, you know, we deal with, have an esoteric, and it's extremely important to realize that we're not speaking from a purely, you know, straight academic source. This confuses some people, of course, who need to adjust their settings to realize what we're doing here. We're looking at a thing in an alternative, esoteric way, because these are esoteric documents. The Bible was written by people who were members of esoteric societies, the Constantine, you know, who founded Christianity in the 4th century, was a member of Sol Invicta cult, which, again, I, you know, believe can be traced back to Egypt, and to the group that I speak of, you know, in the Irish origins book known as the Athenists, and to this Egyptian form of solar occultism. But to be more specific, is what we have to realize is today in our world, especially if you're talking about governments and secret societies and royal houses and so on, the kind of solar occultism these people are using that is sort of instrumental in their tyranny is not exactly the same kind of solar occultism as we might discuss when we're talking about Egypt or Ireland. I always make the point that the kind of solar occultism that they're using today is a warped and skewed version, and these individuals who are behind it today would never have had the power in the ancient days. The power that exists, these power elites, is only available to them because they slaughtered all of the people throughout the centuries, you see, who would have permitted these foul, toxic people from arising in the ranks of these different hermetic societies. So today what we have is a bunch of people who are just derelicts morally, spiritually. They're the spiritually dead, but they have, you know, they're the unworthy users, manipulators, you know, corruptors, plagiarizers of this ancient canon. And therefore, you know, we have to be very wary that when we're studying the subject that we place blame, you see, on the ancients, as if, you know, ancient paganism or something or ancient solar worship was something inherently negative. It wasn't. You know, it was absolutely not. These were the earliest religions of the world, and they were very profound and sacred things. As time went by, though, and as the great tyrannical empires of the world rose, you see, and that impure blood, if you want to call it, you know, gained dominance in the world, they basically absconded with this ancient canon of knowledge, and have been using it manipulatively ever since. So this knowledge is totally about awakening. It's about an age of awakening, and it's about turning the light back on these people who've been using this kind of occult manipulation on the human race, you see. So it's not just history lessons or dry history. It's about studying how history has been manipulated and also an attempt to expose the tiger in the long grass who's been using this kind of knowledge and information, this wisdom, actually. And people go, well, how could they possibly be doing that? And I can give you a very good example of one of the things that we refer to a lot.
Okay.
These Templars, these Masons, and these royal dynasties, one of the elements that the ancient solar and stellar cult used, and I talk about it in the astrotheology book, is geomancy. And that is the aligning of certain buildings, and you know, not only buildings, Jeremiah, but even cities and towns, but certainly monuments, certainly state buildings, capital buildings, schools, institutions, bases, what have you, in alignment with the constellations. So you'll have astronomers here and you'll have astronomers there. You have astronomers at every corner, popping out of every corner. And yet none of these people seem to have ever told us or broadcast. It had to be occultists. It had to be people from, you know, the alternative field to come and tell you that all the cities of the world, you know, not only do, as we said, do they contain the stellar information symbolically involved in the city, in the cities and towns, but they, even the cities and towns themselves, even certain specific statues and objects can be aligned to the constellations. What this also does is, you see, there is a knowledge of geomancy, which is the energy ley lines of the earth, which are also known as synchronic lines, axiotonal lines, the famous ley lines of the dragon paths. Well, you know, it makes a hell of a big difference if you, as a nobleman, as a member of the Stuart dynasty, you know, or the Windsor dynasty, or the Savoys, and you're plunking your schools, your colleges, your monasteries, your churches, and your stately homes on power grid parts of the earth that are very, very electrified and electromagnetically and geomantically extremely powerful, but the rest of us are living in hovels, you know, downtown in what's called a geopathic setup. And this can be corroborated by anyone who's familiar with dowsing or geomancy. They'll corroborate what I'm telling you. And all over the world, these alignments exist, and they have basically monopolized that. That's one example. We're not going to get into it in any more depth than what I've just said, but that's one example of the way in which these individuals have empowered themselves through this knowledge. Now, they have the right to do that. We're not bickering with them saying, oh, but man, you've got to change the way you work. That's no good. It's like Buckminster Fuller said, if you don't like a system, invent something new that will replace the old rotten system. So this is what we're doing. This Age of Awakening is for people to be able to empower themselves in this way, or at least to know, you know, who the enemy is and what weapons they're using.
Wow. And if you're just tuning in out there, we are talking astrotheology with our guest tonight, Michael Tesarian. And someone in the chat room asked about calling in, and that number is 718-508-9887 if you'd like to do so. Now, let me get to a couple of these questions here. One I'm going to save for a little bit later as we move bound to change a little bit of the subject here. Metatron Matrix, I love reading these chat room names off too. Metatron Matrix is asking if December 21st, 2012 would have anything to do with this, and if you had heard of a 26,000-year galactic rotation.
Yeah, it's actually 25,920. It's what's called the Platonic year or the galactic, it's not galactic, it's just it's a zodiological movement based on the what's called the precession of the equinoxes. I go into this in great depth in the astrotheology book and also in the DVD. And actually, pretty much, I think I mentioned the precession of the equinox in almost all the DVDs, if certainly half of the DVD series that I did. It's extremely important. And it's this, what I'll say briefly, since it ties in with what we're talking about, is that that cycle is not familiar to most people who know about the zodiac or know about the horoscope signs. A couple of things about the zodiac that are very important. One is that there's more constellations up there, obviously, more signs of the zodiac than the famous 12. And these other signs, there's about 88 of them, and therefore they're used in the corporate media. They're used on heraldry. They're used all around us, and we would never think of them being astrological, you see. Things like the white unicorn, for instance. We see that, or the whale, for instance, or the tiger, and so on. Second thing is the great cycle that Metatron is talking about. That knowledge and the movement of the sun through that giant cycle also provides symbolism and, more importantly, provides certain harmonics and mathematical harmonics that then you find encoded into the great buildings of the world, like the pyramid, meaning that the time it takes for the sun to pass through one of those houses or through one degree, you start seeing these numbers. You see, or if, say, if you take the number 25920 and divide it by 12 or divide it by 16 or divide it by 216, there's a whole sort of a study of Pythagorean, you know, ancient geometry that is involved with this great Platonic cycle and its divisions. And then you start to find these numbers, including 666 and 216 and 343 and 318, you know, on cars, you find it on products, you find it all over the place. And some of these, you see, are coming down from this great zodiological cycle. As to the 2012, well, you know, this is a thing of great interest, that the ancients appear to have spoken about different ages, different seasons. And according to the Maya prediction specifically, we're in a countdown to the end of, you know, a particular season, and which they say not so much a specific date is important, although they did mention, you know, December 21st, 2012. But they emphasize more this countdown. And they're not the only ones, you see. This is the whole thing. It's not just the Maya. It's the North American Indians spoke about this. You have the Indians, the Vedas, and the Brahman system, you know, talking about this. You have other traditions in which they talk about these countdowns. Not so much important when you're talking calendar dates, but much more important when you're talking astrological or zodiological cycles. This is the thing that has to be understood. But people are not familiar with astrology, so you're going to think it's all just bunkum, because they're thinking in terms of just the clock, you know, and all this, and the shadow on a time dial or whatever. These phases are not external. These phases and cycles, their openings and their closings, are absolutely articulated to consciousness. I'm one of the people who deals very strongly in this, it's part of the difference between myself and many of these other people who are talking about 2012. There are many other differences we have, but one difference is that these people invariably leave consciousness at the door, which is what is happening all throughout the world in these occult subjects. Consciousness is, you know, ignored, basically, except some people who maybe have anecdotal reference to it. Mm-hmm. The zodiac is an internal thing. People who are familiar with my work know that the zodiac is actually a projection of the 12 divisions of consciousness and the modalities of thought, of thinking. Carl Jung understood this. This is the fact. The alchemists understood this. Modern man does not understand it. Modern astrologers don't seem to understand it, even though they'll pay lip service to it. But my God, it's absolutely fundamental to realize that when you're talking calendrical changes, when you're talking about the sun's rotation through the zodiac, you know, annually like we know, or in the greater cycles like we've just been speaking about, all of that stuff is articulated to consciousness. There is a connection and a meaning for the thinking of man, the ego of man. The ego is born, the ego rises to its peak, and the ego then, you know, fails and dies, and then is a rebirth of consciousness. So what is really going on with these prophecies, in fact, what's going on even in the St. John's Book of Revelation, if you know how to read it properly, is exactly the same story of the rise of consciousness, the rising to its peak, and then the falling down. You see, this was a metaphor. These right. many metaphorical books refer to this. It's in so many traditions, it's not even funny how many traditions there are that talk about this. And this is an archive, again, that filmmakers draw upon. There's many movies in which movies are actually, if you know what you're looking at, these movies are actually based on the astrotheological movement of the sun through the different houses. There are even speeches of politicians that are actually designed, been written by people who are familiar with the astrology, and that this very speech, the lines in the speech, refer to, not in a clear way, but in an abstract subtextual way, the movement of the sun through the different houses of the zodiac during the year. This is how these people communicate to us to empower themselves.
Yeah.
And so you have this countdown, and what it basically means is that it is, as Amaya said, an age of revelation, an age of awakening in which the masks are coming down. There's not just 2012, the date, but there's been several other dates. In fact, just I think it was 2 days ago, there was some other important, Mayan, it was a Maya, I should say, date of change. Again, as I say, it's late and it's escaped me, but, you know, John Kellerman and others have spoken, and just 2 days ago, there's another important date of significance. About a year ago, there was another one in November. In fact, this past November, there was another important, you know, date. Then we have the planet Pluto going into the sign of Capricorn this year. It goes in, then it goes in retrograde, then it goes back in again. This is very, very important, you see. And we're going to have many of these points, these nodes, and these cusps, and these cycles of interest. It's like cogs within cogs, you see. So just to focus on the big one is really not, you know, is not a very good thing to do. You focus on the big changes, but it's just like any mechanism. There are wheels within wheels. There are mini cycles. There's the mini cycles of our own lives, you know, attached into the greater cogs that are moving in a bigger way. There's the cog of government. You know, where is government going? Is everything that we know, you know, regarding politics and society and sociology, you know, ready to change, to make a phase shift? Is this what it means in the New World Order? Is this what the United States of Europe is about? We've already seen radical changes, haven't we? With the, you know, the first black president, Obama.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't matter what kind of, you know, spin people have on that, but, you know, there is change coming. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. A lot of the idioms that we know are going to be phased out in the next, you know, few years.
Right.
I think many of them radically in the next 5 years. So we have to be conscious of the larger cycles, which have been about 13 years each. And then we have to be, you know, a little bit aware also of these mini sort of cycles that happen on the way down into this 0 hour of 2012.
Oh, okay. Now we've got a caller on the line here, Michael, if you don't mind taking one.
No, go ahead.
Right. They've been hanging out for a little while there. And Dr. Gary Frick, thanks for hanging on for so long there. I appreciate that.
Thank you. I had a question. Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Carl Jung. Yeah, I was just going to mention him first. I find that a lot of the stuff you're talking about closely relates to Jung's theories about collective unconsciousness. For those people listening who don't know what that means, there's certain symbols that are inherited, that have been inherited over thousands of years in our consciousness. Do you find a lot of what you're talking about relates to Jungian psychiatry or theory?
What was your name again, caller?
Gary Frick.
Gary, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've studied Jung since, 1984 or something like that, you know? So, I mean, and when I mean studied, I mean thoroughly. I've read his collected works no less than 3 times. And that includes the works of Sigmund Freud, and also Wilhelm Reich and Artie Lang, and even the people that, because you know, of course, don't you, that Jung studied himself alchemy and astrology and the ancient, the ancient Hermeticists. So it's not just none of what we talk about ever comes from just one scholar. You know, we have the Eric Newmans, we have the Edingers. You see, these are people who re-brought into the science community, and it was great that that happened in a way, all of the different esoteric traditions, you know, that were in the past. So this is one thing that I have no patience, you know, and I'm sure you don't either, you know, about scientists who debunk a lot of this stuff. Because look, psychotherapy, psychology, one of the greatest sciences known to man, was itself impossible, would never have come about without the, you know, pioneers of the subjects being themselves fascinated with the ancient world. Did you know that, I mean, Sigmund Freud was equal, if not as great, a historian and won prizes for history as he was a psychologist. His specific genius was in Greek history, but he was also fascinated with what was going on in Egypt and so on. And Jung, of course, as we said, was as well. These people were fascinated in ancient religion, and that these were some of the greatest scientists we've known. And this applies to people like Julian James and Bruce Lipton, you see, and many other scientists who really using their brain. They're not afraid to be professionally assassinated, you know, and this goes into even areas of people like, say, Len Horowitz, you know, and others that we could mention. These are people from a scientific background who have no problem looking into the esoteric matters, you know, because it's all study, isn't it? It's all science. But absolutely, to answer your question, my goodness, I cannot ever overemphasize the role, you know. And I have issues with Jung, some of the stuff I don't, you know, totally buy into or agree with. But that's what we have to do. We have to get our arms around all the information, as many philosophers and thinkers and teachers that we possibly can, sift through their information, find out what works, you know, what really makes incredible sense, and move from there, you know, and develop our own system.
Now, when I think of the symbols you're talking about, this, like, for example, the symbolic value of the Bible, I'm trying to get a sense for... Now, obviously, this understanding universal symbols can help, if enough people understand them, could help humanity evolve for the better. But then again, I think you're also saying that some organizations that don't necessarily have our best interest in mind are also interested in these same symbols. My question to you is, how do you see it? What, I guess it's like fire. When man invented fire, it could be used for good or it could be used for very negative. Don't you get confused sometimes wondering, well, all these symbols, they could be used for the good, but some people are using them for negative reasons.
I think we're surrounded by the negative use of it. That's what actually motivated my, you know, work in a way, is I think we are in a situation of complete and utter psychic dictatorship. And I think that the way people are today, you know, the basic disenchantment and the loss of center, you know, is a tragedy that can be traced back to these different kinds of things. I mean, you know, let's not even get into the subject of teen delinquency, the anorexias, the bulimias, the suicides, the deaths, the disenchantment, and the connection to, you know, subliminal advertising, for instance, which is an area I've gone into a great deal. I've even taught children, so, you know, I'm really up to speed on that subject. So it absolutely is a fact that this is going on. And Joseph Campbell, you know, jumps to mind. He inspired my DVDs in a way. And he was always talking about this as well, and basically emphasizing the fact that in the ancient past, the reverence for these symbols that we had and the meaning that we had for these things is now being subverted, right? So anything that used to take your soul up, anything that had the power to empower you, to strengthen you, to advance your sense of spiritual enlightenment, your emotional maturity, can also be used in the wrong hands to take your, you know, soul in the opposite direction, into the miasma of chaos. It's like confusing the language, isn't it? It's like confusing the archetypal language. If the archetypes are being messed with, you better believe that the stereotype, and that means all of us, is going to be, you know, threatened by that, is going to be, you know, thrown off center by that. And therefore, it's not that the symbols are always being used. This is what Joseph Campbell brought out. The mythos, the myth is always going on around you. My work is sort of meant to help people to notice it, to notice the power symbols, to notice the colors, to notice the power of the inanimate, the so-called inanimate, in other words, to understand the language of spirit that's operating all around you. The religions promised to do this for us, and they failed. They haven't done that job. So all of these institutions that were meant to turn us on to all of this understanding, see, have basically corrupted and used that knowledge, you know, for negative purposes. They become institutionalized. But that doesn't mean the process stops. We must continue to understand what our power symbols are, what our own, you know, astrology symbols are, working with the tarot, or just, as I say, you know, the understanding of the ubiquitous use of symbolism, because this is our articulation to the mythos that's already going on. The mythos doesn't stop, but we can either be conscious of it and the miracle and the majesty of that and look at it just like we'd look at a beautiful scenery, a beautiful panorama, the mystery of it, you know, just so we'd listen to a symphony and be turned on by that. And so it's the same thing with this spiritual muse that is always speaking. Some people call it the God force. It doesn't really matter what terms you use, you see. This is going on morning, noon, and night. And that divine force is basically speaking to us in symbols, just like it spoke to our forefathers. And we can either turn off the communication to that. We can bury our antennas, which is what is done, and then we can suffer accordingly, as I said, is what's happening in the world. So when you see all this, pessimism and cynicism and the state of decay in the world, that has roots, that has an origin, and it's about man being unplugged from the greater muse. What religion has done, and what also the New Age movement has done, is come along going, okay, we understand that this is a problem, let us write an A to Z book, create a sort of a roadmap, and then give it to everybody, you know, and it'll suffice. But this is extremely stupid, because, you see, that is not what happens. Each person has an individual relationship to spirit. Everybody has an individual relationship to the matrix. And therefore, to try and, put it into an A to Z level, which is what religion has basically done, is in the end to try and put, you know, the universe into a matchbox. It is not going to work. And therefore, this is what has happened. And people then, you know, feeling disenchanted, have either broken away from religion completely and say, well, you know, I'm not an atheist or agnostic, meaning somebody who doesn't know and doesn't care about anything. Or they just keep trying to bash, you know, squares into round holes. What we have forgotten, you see, is to throw that book away. There's elements of that book which are true. And believe me, as I keep saying in my work, the people who are behind religion know that. They don't read the same book that they give us. They are completely aware of the esoteric traditions. You see, in Judaism and in Christianity and in Islam, the people at the top of the ladder, hey, you better believe they know, and they're members of esoteric traditions that know exactly what's going on. But the rest of us, you know, they give us this one guide, one size fits all attitude, and that is what we have to dispense with, because each person has their own symbolism, their own color, their own tone, their own rhythm, their own particular, you know, dialogue with that universal force. That's what we need to get back in touch with and forget about all this regimented stuff.
Do you feel the New Age movement is losing touch too, or has lost touch?
I think it lost touch a long time ago. I have some very severe criticisms of the New Age movement. You know, it would take a couple of shows to go into all of that. I'm no fan of the New Age movement. I think it's done some terrible... It's actually, you know, I'm a bit suspicious of the people who founded it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I know it has some good people within it, and I've even been close to some of the people who were, you know, the pioneers of the New Age movement in my own life. I came into contact with them when I was young. But I have severe criticisms of the way it went. And again, the fact that it started to leave consciousness at the door and, as we said, create this sort of one-size-fits-all system, you know, this package, super mall, you know, idiotic gimmick-ridden, you know, gimmick-ridden setup, so that the real work doesn't get done. You know, if you, Gary, go on to Google and watch my, you know, 2012 presentation I did in Los Angeles, I make some of the points there about the New Age movement and also in the Origins of Evil YouTube and Google presentation, I make these points, you know, that, again, it's not all bad, but, you know, yeah, it, to me it got very waylaid, and it provided a lot of gimmicks so that people who didn't really want to do the real work, who didn't really want to get in touch, you know, with the psychology on a deeper level, you know, this spinner rack, self-help mumbo-jumbo, you know, provided a perfect avenue. And, of course, you know, people will argue with that, and then, you know,
Well, it's just like, it's basically, no, I understand, it's like another religion. I have one last question for
exactly.
you. Do you feel humanity is ultimately progressing, ultimately we're headed towards a positive change in the long run, that we're evolving? I'd like to think we're evolving. Or do you feel we've actually going in the opposite direction? If we are going in the opposite direction, do you feel that's a bump in the road, or I wanted to hear your feelings about that.
Well, I'm very worried about the way things are going, obviously.
Yeah.
I think that the people who are in control of, you know, the state systems, the established systems, are heading for real trouble. They don't mean well for the rest of the world. But I'm also a person, and coming out of Ireland maybe taught me this, I don't know, but it is a metaphysical truism, that sometimes things need to burn. Sometimes, you know, there is a deconstructive element here. Perhaps the change comes about when, you know, things get so bad that, you know, people then look for another way. This has happened in the past, and we are in desperate need of new systems of government, because I'm not against government. What I am against is state control. There's a big difference between state control in the new DVD that's coming out next week called Architects of Control. This is a series I'm doing. You know, we look into all of these matters. And there's a difference between state control, which is what we've had now for several hundred years, and people mistake that when they talk about the evils of government. What the evils are not of government. Government is really all men coming together, you know, to get things done for the betterment of their society. State is when a certain oligarchical, plutocratic elite come together to feather their own nests and to basically confiscate, you know, murder and sequester, you know, and sell us all out. So there's a big difference there. So the state apparatus is something that is corrupt, doesn't mean well for us, and basically wants to, you know, bring in another feudal situation. Or alternatively, like I've spoken many times before, they're hungry for a postmodern world, a post-human world, in which the emotionless man, the drugged man, the conditioned man, the programmed man, you know, is where we're heading. So yes, there's tremendous problems on the road in the future if we don't watch out. The counterbalance to that is, as bad as things get, and I've said this before, you know, 9/11 shook people up, did it wake them up, is sometimes, and as I said, it is a spiritual, this is a metaphysical truism. It sometimes takes a person or a nation to go through the dark night of the soul, to be burned down to ashes, you see, to be brought back to carbon before you can rise to the gold level again. It's pure alchemy. So it's both, Gary, you know, and I'm sure you know this yourself, it sometimes takes you to lose all the lies, lose all the deceivers, get rid of all the, you know, the wrong energy around you and inside of you. It's a sort of a cleansing process. So as a person who comes from a metaphysical and occult background, I do see all the darkness, but I'm not afraid of it, and I even see its positive aspect.
Mm-hmm.
What you see in the world, and this is a huge criticism I have of the New Age movement, since you were talking about that, is that that is exactly the opposite of what the New Age people and most of the religions and most of everyone in the world does. And it's also what most of these 2012 scholars refuse to do. They don't want to look at the dark side. They're running headlong from it, thinking about utopias and glowing paradisical, you know, divine this and angels coming down and Flash Gordon's on his way and, you know, tomorrow's going to just be wonderful. And they don't want to look at the darkness of what is here. Well, any psychologist, any Zen, any martial artist, anybody who really is of the spiritual tradition, any Taoist, any shaman, is not going to tell you that nonsense. He's going to say, face the facts, face what is happening right now in the shadow gallery, because that is what you have made. That is what mankind has made. That is what you have created. Deal with this, and then, you know, out of the ruins of that, if you deconstruct that, and you start to understand why this problem got made, then you're halfway to a greater solution. But to jump over all of that and to try to bypass it, well, that simple escapism, and this is what is rampant in the world today, escapism amongst the teens, escapism amongst the middle class, escapism, you know, in all sorts of fashions. You can see it in this recent election and, you know, all of the false hope and all of this other nonsense, the inability for people to face facts. And you see, the man who's not going to face facts is a human being who's insane. He's not in his reason, he's not in his critical judgment, and he's open then to being manipulated.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gary, we appreciate you calling in. Yeah, we're getting ready to hit the break here. So it's always a pleasure.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, it's Dr. Gary Frick, a regular caller on the show, and actually
yeah,
a guest on the show quite a few times himself as well.
Good questions.
Yeah, we enjoy him always calling in. Well, Michael, we are right at the halfway point of the show. Time to take a little bit of a break, take a breather, and we come back. Well, I've got some follow-up questions from the chat room and a couple more, and we'll definitely get those in as well. So sound good to you?
Absolutely, Jeremiah.
All right. Well, everyone out there tuning in, we're going to take a quick little break, so hang tight with us, and we will be back in a few moments with our special guest tonight, Michael Tesarian. And we've got a little bit of some new music here. I think you guys will really enjoy this second song on this, so back in a few moments.
Visit www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com today to sign up for our free newsletter, join as a member of our forum, or browse our online store where you can find books, CDs, and DVDs, like a signed copy of The President's Vampire by Robert Damon Schneck, or the complete works of Dr. Gary Frick for only $20. That's four books signed by Dr. Frick that carry a great message. You also find downloadable products like Mysteries Magazine and the Donald Kehoe interviews, DVDs featuring Charlie Carlson and Mr. Lobo. So go to www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com today and be a part of the show.
All right, everyone, welcome back. You are tuned in to Shadows in the Dark, and quite a response from that song there in the chat room. I just had to play it. It's just such a crazy song, but I'm so sorry. Well, like I said, you are tuned in to Shadows in the Dark here, syndicated on Black Vault Radio Network at blackvaultradio.com, the Para X Network at para-x.com, a Planet Paranormal at planetparanormal.com, and the UFO Paranormal Radio Network at paranormalradionetwork.com. Of course, you can always tune in live right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/shadows-in-the-dark. Well, let's welcome our guests back on. We are talking with Michael Tesserian, and we've been discussing astrotheology. So, Michael, I've got quite a few follow-up questions that we can get to here from the chat room, quite a few questions coming from them. So you ready for that?
Absolutely.
All right. I hope I didn't torture you too much with that song. I don't know why I decided to play that. Well, kind of following back to the question about December 21st, 2012, Metatron Matrix wanted to also know if their birthday is on the 21st of December, apparently, and they will be turning 26 years old and wanting to know if there was anything about that, if there's any significance between their age being 26 on that date.
Well, I guess there might be. I mean, it sounds interesting. I mean, you got 26 for a male. You're within a very short time from what's called a Saturn return. So that sounds to me, you know, very significant that a person is approaching their Saturn return on the very year that, and of course, in some males' lives, the Saturn return is when they're 26. So, you know, in this particular individual's life, that particular three-year cycle is going to be of great significance indeed. It'll probably be, you know, a time in which the person, their own destiny, they get a real strong sense of it, if they haven't already. Or on a next level down, it will be a pretty drastic or major change in their domestic setup. You know, you either meet the people that you're meant to meet. Mm-hmm. Some people call it your soul family. At times like that, you know, you're introduced to that. Or it could mean that just the negative people in your life, the people that, you know, are not meant to be around anymore, you know, start falling away. And a lot of people can feel it as a time of sort of isolation and alienation, you know. It's, again, not the way to think of it, but a lot of people are threatened by these great cusps. Because we have these rites of passage, you know, through all of our lives. And with these bigger cycles that affect the whole of mankind, you know, these are also rites of passage. So it's not that some end is going to happen, you know, like some people have spoken about. It's that here is another rite of passage, except at this time it's a very, you know, major rite of passage. And as I said, it's not so much about one date in specific. It's about the cycle we're under, you know, for the last many years. Mm-hmm. And especially now that Pluto is going into Capricorn, this is a massive, you know, amping up of that kind of energy.
Mm-hmm. All right. This question... we got one more from Metatron, so let's get this one in here. Wanting to know if the constellation or if Sirius played any part in any kind of symbolism.
Sirius is one of the most important of the archetypal symbols right across the board in all nations, in all symbolic canon, and this includes advertising. This symbol of Sirius is, you know, found in so many advertisements, and also on many corporate logos and on many corporations. But most importantly, it is probably the star of the greatest importance to Freemasonry. And believe me, that's they've got others that rank very high. For instance, Spica, which is in Virgo, is hugely important to them, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And Regulus, Aldebaran, you know, Antares, and others. But Sirius heads the lot, basically. And it's very many reasons for that. One is it's because it's in the northern sky. It's I think it's in Gemini now, but it used to be associated with Cancer. You know, basically what I mean is that Sirius was the star that was most important in Egypt because the appearance of the star Sirius meant the rising of the waters.
Right.
And so this was then commemorated in certain tarot cards like the Chariot and like the Star card number 17. You see, and so forth and so on. And hugely, hugely important. But Sirius is also the secret symbol of America, because the birthday of America is very close to the time when the star Sirius is prominent in the sky. It's called the dog star, you know.
Yeah.
And it surrounds the occult birth of America, which was timed the 4th of July, and then a little bit later on in July. And then other Masonic events took place in the sign of Virgo, which is about 3 months later, near Spica. So Spica and Sirius are actually the occult rulers, the stellar or astrological rulers of America.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. And I know, like, you know, kind of talking about it being, you know, the nickname Dog Star, kind of where, you know, the dog days came from.
Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Here's a question from TRF in our chat room. Again, kind of more, you know, along the lines of 2012. And for those who aren't tuned in, I have all of our questions noted down, just trying to keep some of the ones on the same topic together. But they're asking, has 2012, the world end prediction, has it been predicted using, you know, some of the other methods that you've talked about tonight?
Yeah, it's every See, every different nation had its own system of timing and measurements.
Mm-hmm.
And how this works is because they don't all use the sun. In astrology of the Western world that we know today, we use the sun primarily, right, to, you know, chart. So when you're talking about the zodiac today, and when you're talking about what's a year today or a month, we're talking about the sun, we're talking about the moon. But, you know, the Gaels and the Goths, the Indians, the Egyptians and the Maya, you know, they also noted the movement of other luminaries and planets that were more of interest to them, or let's say were more sacred to them, like the star Sirius. That was hugely important. But then there comes times when, for some reason, the worship in ancient days of these luminaries stops. Like, for instance, for many, many thousands of years, the star Sirius, all the priests of the ancient temples, you know, followed Sirius. And then, because Sirius started to fall low on the horizon and wasn't anymore a good marker for the year, it wasn't a good marker for these longer processional cycles, they dropped it and they moved on to, say, you know, another star, and so forth and so on. So the Maya's predictions are based on Venus and the moon, you see, and the rotations of the planets, and they come up with a different kind of system, a different kind of mathematics, a different kind of zodiac. And I am a scholar who is not concerned at all with the technical side of it. You know, this is not important to me, and first of all, there's other scholars who've gone well into that, you know, the Jose Agüeleses and the Calamans and John Jenkins and these other people who are more from a left brain point of view, looking, you know, they need to have this proved to them scientifically. You know, I've never needed that. You know, that's corroborative and that's fine, but from the esoteric tradition, it's what all this means psychologically and spiritually that is a far, far more interesting subject to me. Right. And therefore, as I said, all these that these people are using this type of calculation, or these guys over here are using this calculation, you know, look, it's all different. It's just candles of different color. It's just, you know, it's just sundials of different metal. You know what I mean? It's just tea out of different cups. Big deal. You know, it's interesting. It's fascinating. If that kind of science interest helps, you know, to get average people into the subject, by all means, that's magnificent. But to me, that is basically child's play. It is not the most important thing. What's important is the psychological, psychic, spiritual, you know, implications of these kinds of things. That is what is of vital interest. Where are we heading, you know? So it's okay, you've got the car and you've got the steering wheel, but isn't it important where the journey is you're going to take this?
Right.
You know, is it just going to be around the neighborhood, or are you really going to go and see the world? So it's about what our intentions are and what this all means for consciousness is the most important thing to me.
Mm-hmm. And TRF has asked kind of a follow-up question, just kind of clarifying, which I have definitely heard things along this line. So you're kind of saying it's really just the calendar ending rather than the world.
Oh, yeah. It's nothing to do with the world ending at all.
All right.
It's a cycle of the known. It's a cycle of what we have come to understand, what we've known in the past. And it's a winding down. And anyone with a brain, anyone with any awakened eyes at all, can see that it is a cycle, that things have been, in fact, going on like this. There are many things coming to a close, both in our personal lives and also on a more, you know, social level.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I tell you, the questions are just flying through the chat. I'm trying to note them down as fast as I can. So anybody out there, if I missed your question, I apologize. Just type it in again. I will definitely try to get it in. All right, here's one from Hunka Hunka. Again, gotta love the chat room names. Do you believe in Hollow Earth, and could Atlantis be connected with that?
I do. I do. I have studied Hollow Earth for many, many years. Since, again, starting that research, I think it was about 1983. It might have even, I think I may have even heard of it before, but I've made a detailed research. Again, remember I was talking about how my researches began in Ireland?
Right.
Well, in the British context, the Hollow Earth in Scandinavian mythology, you have many references to it, you see, so it plays a huge role. Nobody can get into these esoteric matters for too long before they're going to come across this subject matter. As far as it's connected to Atlantis, though, that is not as strong, you know what I mean? Because all cultures of the world have the Hollow Earth stories. And just like they have the Atlantis stories, but Atlantis to me was one place. It was, you know, it was a place on the northwest. It was a location. Hollow Earth is a global phenomena in which, you know, you would have the entrances to these Hollow Earths, entrances in many places. Tying into what I was talking about, remember in the previous segment, mm-hmm. about the geomancy and how these the noble people of the world, so-called oligarchs, are able to position their buildings.
All right.
Well, the hollow is the origin, the root of the word hollow is the same as we use for the word holy.
Mm-hmm.
H-O-L-Y.
Right.
So a holy place, like a church or a cathedral or a monastery, when the ancient people said we're going to the holy place, they actually used to mean they're going to the hollow place, the place of the gods, the place of the, and we know this, we've picked up in Greek mythology, of course, where there's many stories about the oracle living in the caves, right?
Right.
And when you went to see the oracle, she'd come out of the caves. They lived in the caves. There was a whole cult of people in the ancient days. It's very well known. You know, Robert Graves and Fraser have written on this. The whole idea of the oracle living underground. We have marble caves all over Ireland. You know, this is a common motif with the Sami, with the different Nordic shaman type people. So what would happen then? Because people are going to say, hey, well, I can't find any of these hollow earth entrances today. Yeah, but what happens if the modern holy places have actually been positioned right on top of the entrances that our ancient forefathers used to know as the hollow places? That would be a perfect way to conceal those entrances, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It would be a perfect way to supersede, yeah, and plunk your own, established religion. It would be another way of also obscuring what was there before. So there's multiple reasons why, from the Roman times and onwards, especially in a British context, the holy places, and this includes cathedrals, churches, institutions, I made a deep study of all of this, and also stately homes, believe it or not. And also you can, even in the designs of the architecture of some of these places, in the floor designs of most of the stately homes and institutions, I mean what kind of murals or checkered floors they have or other kinds of images, in churches the stained glass windows will tell you the story, the shapes in the architecture, the number symbolism, will even let you know whether or not it's over an entrance to Hollow Earth, believe it or not. So this is a study I've engaged in, you know, and not all of them are entrances, but you see, we have this issue that the ancient people knew these places, knew about the Hollow Earth, and then, you know, subsequent post-Christian, you know, hierarchs did not want us to know about this and wanted to disassociate us from this whole knowledge. But it's a tremendous study, that study of the Hollow Earth and the theory of that.
Wow, that is interesting. Now, what, I mean, can you give some examples of some symbols we might see that kind of indicates that they're sitting over a place like that?
Well, yes. There's lots. Mm-hmm. For instance, there's a whole study of spiral trees. For instance, the way a tree will turn. Some very ancient trees, churches were put on groves. They were put on ancient Druidic groves. And so certain trees will tell you what kind of underground water there is, whether it's a good vortex or a negative vortex. The stained glass windows will often even show you images that can tell you that this place was on a sacred site, just the symbolism, the iconography that they will use, other sort of features. For instance, many churches have graveyards around them, and many churches have gargoyles on them.
Mm-hmm.
Gargoyles and graveyards were put there specifically to do what? To keep you and me away. Hollow Earth places were places of activity. In ancient times, they were called, you know, the breath of the dragon. These were the lairs, you see. So the post-Christian mythographers demonized these places. But just in case Johnny, who's drunk coming home from the pub, walking down a lonely lane, which is so many villages and towns have this, what would happen, you see, if you heard noises or you saw lights, or you heard, you know, some sort of rumbling that attracted your attention to a potential Hollow Earth site. So something had to be done. So if you put graveyards and gargoyles leering at people, we might laugh at them today, but believe me, those were frightening as hell generations back. Wouldn't that be it's what's called apotropaic. People need to look up the word.
Mm-hmm.
Apotropaic. They have what's called an apotropaic meaning. It means that they scare the living bejesus out of you so that you're not going to be hanging out there, you know, hopefully that you won't see or hear anything untoward. And, of course, sometimes that's broken. Sometimes people, in fact, have seen, you know, Johnny coming home drunk, in fact, has seen some weird apparitions or heard some noises. Of course, nobody's going to believe you. So this is in the folklore of many places and around churchyards and around graveyards. There have been sightings. But, of course, you know, traditionally people say, oh, you're just drunk, you know, forget it. But, you know, many places, if you go, especially on the west coast of Ireland, you know, people know some of the truth. They can tell you some amazing things if you get them to talk. There's some very, very interesting, you know, theories about all of this. And basically it ties into the Hollow Earth theory.
Hmm. That is interesting. Just a looks like, well, as a matter of fact, we have a caller on the line. So let's get them on here. So caller from 540, what's your name and where are you from?
Hello, this is Elizabeth. I'm from Southwest Virginia.
Oh, well, hello, Elizabeth. Do you have a question or a comment for Michael?
Sort of both. I've been listening to him for, I guess, maybe close to a year, and my comment would be that the things he talks about takes a lot of research, a lot of time to understand. And if anyone has ever listened to Noam Chomsky, that's one of the comments he made, that you can't really be on a one-hour, two-hour show and explain the things that you're talking about. And I would like to get just Michael's comments on that fact, that what he's talking about is just so complicated that it's really hard to explain in that time frame.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. You're absolutely right. And, you know, that's why my, you know, Origins and Oracles DVD series is 60 hours long. Next week we have the Irish Origins of Civilization DVD coming out. It's 11 hours long. You know, I mean, it's a series. It's it's 11 shows all fused together in one, making up basically a series, you know, that's in excess of 10.5 hours long. And even that, I was telling my co-producer, even that, you know, as you're saying, Elizabeth, is probably half what it would be needed. You know, but who on earth is going to, not even me, will do a 20-hour DVD or anything? I mean, I've got to draw the line somewhere, you know. But I said Joseph Campbell was my inspiration because he made, you know, about 300 shows or something like that. His multiple, you know, his transformations of Myth Through Time, his multi VHSs, multi DVDs, you know. So when I came to America in 91 and I saw what he was doing, he was a big inspiration for me to say, go ahead and do it long. Don't edit it for sound bites. So, Elizabeth, the upside of what you're saying also, you see, is that, yes, it does take a lot of research and it does take more time. But, you see, we have to take that time because if you turn on the television, look what they're doing. Everything.
I appreciate the work you've done to look up all these fantastic quotes and comments from books that people would have never thought about or found before. I really appreciate that.
I appreciate you. You know, that's very sweet of you. And, you know, it can feel that nobody cares. So every person that, you know, compliments me on my work, it's really heartfelt. And, you know, it's great to hear that because, you know, a lot of this work, you do feel you're doing it in the dark. And you do feel, you know, that who's listening, who's paying attention. But the positive emails I get and the, again, people like yourself, you know, it makes it all worthwhile. It makes you feel you're not just totally alone, you know, doing it.
No, you're not. You're doing a great job. Thank you.
Did you have a question, though? Or?
Oh, no, that was it. Thanks.
Okay, right. Thanks, love. Thank
I'm
you very
on
much.
I'm on your forum. I'm going to go on your forum.
Okay,
talk to you later.
Good. We'll see you there, then. See you at the forum.
All right, thank you. All right, thank you, Elizabeth. And you know that, you know, on the side of actually doing shows like this, you know, I want to kind of add in there that for me, a lot of, you know, the purpose of having, you know, guests on like yourself is to get people interested. By no means could you ever explain something within an hour or 2 hours, especially a lot of the topics that we discuss here, but it's a way to get people interested, to bring it to the forefront so people know it is out there and lead them in a direction so they can.
Well, and I was just going to say, you see, sometimes it doesn't even take an hour because you know what happens? All through my life, I've met people that as soon as you start to talk about any of this, it's cut off.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You're getting the situation which changed the subject quick. You know, so in most of our life, you know, and most of my life, you know, there is no interest.
Mm-hmm.
It's only in recent times, like you say, you know, through the media and through the news and then creating our own media things, like you've gone out and created your own show. I mean, that's what it basically takes to do.
Right.
If you're waiting for, you know, the local yokel and your buddies, you know, of a Saturday night or whoever else, even, you know, sort of adult friends or whatever, anyone, basically the whole nine yards, the moment that you start talking about stuff like this, you know, they act like they've been tasered or something like that. And it's an instant, you know, edit, cut, stop, delete, do not, you know, press delete. Shut up, Michael. You know, not that I ever really engaged anyone, but there's the few people that, you know, you think, okay, this person looks a bit receptive. Maybe I'll talk about what I do, you know, and what I study. Yeah, again, I've done it not a lot in my life, but there's been times when I've done it, you know, and it hasn't worked. The people are not interested, and you have to respect that.
Yeah.
So you're in a situation where, wow, there is a lot of research that goes into it, but there is a lot of areas in which you just cannot approach this stuff with people at all.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. Now, speaking of your forum, we haven't, and I apologize, haven't gave out your website tonight, so please go ahead and do that before I tend to forget or something.
Well, I have about 11 websites, but if they just go to michaeltesarian.com, it's a navigation page, and there you can get to all the different websites clearly explained, and you can also get into the forum and, you know, into the articles and interviews. So michaeltesarian.com is absolutely the one that people want to go to because that features links to everywhere.
All right, and that is Tesarian is T-S-A-R-I-O-N for all those out there wondering how in the world do I spell that. So
that's great. People can also go visit architectsofcontrol.com because next week we have the DVD coming out on that. It's a 2.5-hour DVD on 2012 and the future where man's going. It's actually entitled Mass Control and the Future of Mankind. And this is coming out in about a week or 10 days, and also comes out the Irish Origins of Civilization DVD, which, as I said, is about 11 hours long. That's a series, and it's a companion to the Irish Origins book.
Okay. And for anybody who does have any problems finding, we have all of this linked from our website, just www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com. So, all right, well, let me got some more questions here. I tell you, the questions are just flying in, so definitely some interest. And let me pull one up here. Now, just kind of a follow-up that we had in the chat room on the whole Hollow Earth, kind of making the comment or throwing the question out there, could Hollow Earth be connected to the energy grid?
Yes, it is. Hollow Earth has changed because the Earth has suffered major cataclysms in the past. So many entrances that used to be well-known in ancient times are no longer there. In places like Armenia, places like Cappadocia and Turkey, even South America in the Andes, and also in the Amazon jungle, you see, there's all been a history of entrances. But then because a lot of them have been covered up by the powers that be, like we've been talking about,
mm-hmm.
And then the Earth has suffered various waves of cataclysm, and that includes water flooding, submergence of certain land masses, you see. So when you're studying Hollow Earth is that you're studying literature and information that's many thousands of years old, and so it's useless as a guide to you because, of course, you know, the Earth has changed. The cities have changed. The cities have come and gone. I mean, they're finding people who, you know, Viking ships underneath cities and all sorts of crazy stuff. You know, they've just found tunnels again under Los Angeles. So,
right.
You know, the theory is valid, but, you know, how much headway can you make? You know, I tried to make as much as I could in a British context and still talk about the subject in the Atlantis DVD. I go into Hollow Earth and I've got my theories. I may publish on it later on, you know, my life or whatever. It's a tremendous study, the king under the mountain, you know, the very fact that human beings are buried under the earth, you know, after they die. The symbolism of the elves and the trolls, and even the word elf, where does it come from? You know, the incredible etymology connected to these various terms and what they mean. And in Ireland, of course, we have, you know, the leprechauns and the banshee, and we have an entire culture of the ancient megalithic people who are actually, in their own history, changed their form to live in the earth, in what they call the cities, or the she. In Gaelic, which is the underground places. This is a huge, you can't get past two pages of any type of Irish mythology and you're not, you know, going to be tripping over the concept of Hollow Earth. In fact, if you watch most science fiction films, including the Star Trek series and many others, even modern ones today,
mm-hmm.
in about 8 out of 10 of all science fiction, that's from the time that science fiction began, way back with the British sci-fi, leading all the way up to the most modern versions of sci-fi, in 8 of 10 of those shows, there's a Hollow Earth reference.
Oh.
Absolutely. It may be not obvious.
Yeah.
You know, but people, you know, if you're aware of Hollow Earth and you know how it's metaphorized, you know how they use metaphors for it, you will find that there's many references, not just in science fiction movies, but in many movies, but specifically in people pick up the movie The Island, for instance. There's a, you know, very famous movie, The Island. That has Hollow Earth references in it. Star Trek II, the movie, has Wrath of Khan. I'm saying ones here, they're very obvious for people to go. You know, they'll remember or they'll acknowledge. So, but the list is endless. You know, even in Star Trek 6 and 5, you have Hollow Earth references. It's just monumental how many Hollow Earth references there are out there when you know what you're looking at, what you're being told by the media.
All right. Okay, here's another one, and hopefully we'll get all these questions. And we got about 23 minutes or so left, and they're still shooting questions out there, and I'm writing as fast as I can. What about someone is asking, I didn't write their name down from the chat room, and I apologize for that. The winter sun story of, now they're saying the Aztecs or the Toltecs. They weren't sure which one.
I don't understand a question at all. What is it?
About the, if you knew the winter sun story?
No, that's not something that's familiar at all.
Okay. All right, then.
Well, by the way, though, if people are also interested in Hollow Earth, if you study, pick up a book on the Zuni Indians. Well, people can pick up books on the Hopi Indians and go to their creation myths, like the origin of their people. These are commonly found in any library or online. Just go Zuni creation myths or Zuni, you know, myths. Right. And you will have some of the most fascinating Hollow Earth revelations coming out of the Zuni and the Hopi people. Like I said, I studied, you know, in a British and European context or, you know, Scandinavian context. But the two that have just jumped to mind for American readers is study the Hopi origins and the Zuni origins, and you will have very unbelievable, fascinating Hollow Earth accounts.
Oh, well, that's good, because there was somebody saying they were going to have to go do some research on it, so there is a place for them to start. So I appreciate you getting that out there. Now, here's a question from Dr. Gary Frick. He's also hanging out in the chat room. Wanted to know if you foresee government systems evolving that is even superior to democracy.
Well, it depends what you mean by superior to democracy. Half the elite of the world prefer tyranny as a democracy.
Right.
And first of all, we don't have democracy.
Right.
We have never had democracy. While you have the state control, you will never have democracy. Democracy does come with government, but that's when government is ruled by the people. You saw elements of this at the very, very early stages when the Puritans first came to America, and even then it was an extremely, sort of a low-level communism, or whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. where people try to live without state, you know, without the state. But basically, apart from one or two instances, and mostly those were in a state of trauma in the world, we have had for hundreds and hundreds of years state control. So any conversation or any political debate that even brings up words like democracy has just got to be like, what the hell are you talking about? The terms like republicanism, democracy, freedom of the people, liberty, justice, fraternity, etc., is like, are these people need straitjackets? It shows you that these people are just parroting newspapers, parroting school book stuff. They are absolutely gaga. Understand? You know, it's like, what the hell are you talking about? We have had nothing but plutocracy, oligarchy, and state control from the time of the founding of America and long before that, this thing, you know, began. And it got very strong during the period of the rise of Protestantism. In fact, it's debatable. Some scholars think that without Protestantism, this is what, and I'm not talking about the religion as people know it, I'm talking about the ideology of Protestantism, how it works sociologically, how the work ethic and the whole ideology that work is good for God and all of this kind of thing. So coming out of Holland, coming out of England, you see, but specifically Holland, you have the rise of Protestantism, and with it is man's different understanding of how the hierarchy works from God down. And with it comes the state control of very, very powerful, rich oligarchs, you see, basically confiscating the rights of people, confiscating the land, confiscating the wealth. So today in an American context, when people are talking about Federal Reserves, you know, having great power and fractional banking and all sorts of Ameros and CAFTAs and NAFTA coming in, and believe me, this Obama isn't going to slow down any of this. In fact, he's going to even increase the problem. So, you know, people are going to be, their hopes are going to be dashed if they think this character is any different than all the rest of the pundits from which he's from the same pig pen.
Mm-hmm.
But when people point to all of these things that are happening in an American context, they don't realize that this is business as usual. The confiscation of the land was done by the, you know, the Hudson Bay Company and the Massachusetts Bay Company and the Virginia Company. Who do you think owns those companies? The Virginia Company and the Massachusetts Bay Company was owned by only 100 men when it started. And of those 100 men, six were the billionaires, six were the real people who controlled. So how can 330 million people claim that they own anything or have any kind of democracy when less than 10 people, some say it's 13, and probably now throughout the world it's 300. The great Dr. John Coleman has always spoken of a committee of 300. You know, he may be absolutely right there because the numbers fit. So you have all the oily rags running the shop, and then you have this group within the middle, you see, who have run these big companies that have confiscated all the mineral wealth, all the diamond mines, just like Cecil Rhodes is known to have done in South Africa. My God, you think he was alone there? America has suffered the same thing. They shuffle papers around to make you think that that hasn't happened, and they have you waving American flags and celebrating days of independence as if something really is independent or free in America, when the place is one of the worst feudal state systems you can ever imagine. It's worse than communism, because at least in communist Russia, you knew that you were under a totalitarian system.
Right.
It happens in America, but people think they're free. This is the problem.
I definitely agree with you on that.
Did you know that every president, and I must say that except Jefferson, Jefferson wasn't as tied in. Jefferson was part of this, but Jefferson didn't care about money, so he had no personal stake in any of this. But apart from Jefferson, who personally couldn't give a damn about money, every other person you can think of that was in politics in the early days of America, you know, in the early days of the presidency, were members or directors of the Hudson Bay Company or the Massachusetts Bay Company, the Virginia Company, and, you know, we mentioned these companies, lists of them, that own America. My most, you know, focus, though, is not so much about who was part of this country, you know, known Americans who were part of this country, these companies. That's interesting. I'm more interested in who these, you know, the British aspect, that these were British organizations. These were people who came from the old state dynasties of Europe who then moved in, you see, and then they had as their employees and their directors American presidents. This is what's worrisome to me. And, of course, then we tie it into the whole understanding that a president is not a political title at all. It's a business title. President of a corporation for 4 years. So right. Our presidents reign for 4 years. But the advisors and the people behind that, the money men, you know, they're in forever. So people have to wake up and realize that there is no such thing as democracy in any place in the world unless you're in some, you know, outback village of some wild, you know, place in Africa or somewhere where people are still living, you know, in huts or something. Then you'll have a democracy, yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and you know what? I agree with you on that 100%. Now, you know, with some of the things that you say and some of the things you talk about and the research that you've done, do you ever fear or has it even happened, any type of retaliation?
Well, I don't really talk about my personal life or any of that stuff going
okay.
on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, you know, look, all I can say to that, I get that question a lot. You know, I just have a habit of never talking about my private life. So, you know, I can say it does go on, but, you know, I'm not going to get into details about it.
No, basically...
You know, I have Irish on one side, Jeremiah, and I have Viking Norwegian on the other. So there's your question answered when it comes to the question of fear.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, and I can respect not wanting to go into detail. No problem there. All right. We've got some other questions here from the chat room, and this one's from Bloodsport, and they're asking if you can explain the reptilians and the Nephilims.
Well, I refer the commenter there, questioner, to my book on Atlantis, because I go into detail there. It's very important. It's a very interesting subject, but there's a lot of disinformation on it. And mm-hmm. not just disinformation, it's just, you know, genuine mistakes. You know, we all make mistakes. We all are learning as we go. And so some of the information that's out there from other authors, you know, is in my opinion, not correct. And therefore, I actually partly wrote the Atlantis book and has a large appendices section in the book also that goes into this question of who are the reptilians. I do believe they exist. I do believe that they feature in mythology, you see. Because remember, my whole work comes out of mythology. It's studying it's very much like Joseph Campbell and very much like Emmanuel Velikovsky, although I immediately say that these are great men. I'm not in their league at all, but I have the same interests. And so by studying the ancient mythologies of the world, you do come across this. You absolutely do come across this many times, the references to the reptoids and the reptilians and the dragon men and all of this kind of caper. And so it did feature in my book, but my own particular theory, you know, the author, the questioner needs to go to the DVD or to the book itself because it's too long drawn out to explain. It would just be far too involved, you know. It's interesting, you know, my theories on HAARP, my theories on the space programs, you see, my theories on the reptilians are a bit controversial. They're not the same as what others have written, you know.
Okay. And we've got another question from TRF, kind of back on what we were speaking about before, the reptilians there. So I want to kind of jump back to that so we can kind of keep that flowing. Do you suggest any alternatives or actions that, and the way they put it was, we the people could take?
Well, you see, first of all, you have to get one of the steps is to try and get back to the Constitution. Some of the first principles of the Constitution are very strong, you know, because why I'm attracted to that is because in the Constitution of the United States of America, it says that the Constitution is being drawn up so that no oligarchical power, I think it's the 8th article, you know, that talks about this. It's like one of the, it's the opening statements of the Constitution prohibit the rise of any oligarch or any king or any sovereign, you see, this kind of thing, that the people are sovereign. So that is, you know, one of the bases we have to use. Is that the only one? That's why I'm not only, you know, just keep on talking about the Constitution. Because remember, my whole thing, as I said, comes from a psychic point of view. If men don't have a clean moral constitution inside their head, no document is going to give it to you if you don't have it inside. But just to answer your question for practical purposes, you know, looking at the Constitution and adhering to those original precepts is very, very important, because that will stop a lot of the negative influx of these oligarchs. Mm-hmm. Secondly, is that it is absolutely imperative for people to realize that you are operating in a one-party system, so they need to cop out of this whole political agenda, because you are then responsible for the mass murder that these people are doing in your name.
Mm-hmm.
But by opting out, which any hippie can do, is not what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Opt out and then re-educate yourself legally. In other words, use the same powers that the Knights Templars, you see, the Freemasons, the bishops, the clergy, and all of these people use. Don't listen to the people who say, oh, that will never work. Well, it seems to work well enough for these pedophile priests. It seems to work well enough for the Knights Templars who never see a day in court. It seems to do well for these white-collar executive people who never do a day in jail when they've ripped millions of people off and had all scandals attached to them. So what we need to do is empower ourselves with the system that's already laid there. See, what we've got to realize is, forget about anything radical. The system already has in place things that you can use that these other oligarchs are using. You don't need to reinvent the wheel for a lot of it. This is what I think stresses people out, is they go, oh my God, this is so massive, what can I do? Well, as a matter of fact, it's very, very simple. There's already in place. They're not perfect. I'm not saying they're perfect. But
right.
If you want to move up from where you are, and as many people have done it, it's extremely important. Even if that importance is merely psychological, that you have greater psychological empowerment, I actually believe it will give you greater empowerment, it actually will give you legal empowerment, ability to really take on people like the presidents and the prime ministers and the potentates to impeach them properly. These things can be, in fact, done, but they need power from the people. And what kind of power? Legal power. Know your legal rights, even on the most rudimentary level, you see, so that you can fix these corrupt police chiefs, and you can fix these mayors, and you can fix these governors, so that they'll shake in their pants instead of doing the corrupt things that they do, you see, if the people start to get empowered legally. No speaker has ever said this. No public person, not even the Martin Luther Kings or the Malcolm X's or any of the other, you know, people in power, is because all of these people are Masons. They all know not to tell people to get in touch with their legal sovereignty, you see. But if you don't have legal sovereignty, you're not going to have any other kind of sovereignty. You know, so normally I talk about the spiritual and esoteric and mystical aspects of empowerment, but, you know, framed in the context of what you're asking, I would say that people need to read the Constitution and get really up on that, up to speed on that. And they also need to then empower themselves legally, just like any lawyer downtown is doing. There are certain already made protections and powers that you can have, you know, that are very, very important for people and their families to get to knowledge upon. And it's incredibly empowering to do that. I have my website. We have links to if people come to the forum, and then they can go to, I think it's Mankind's Future page. There's a bunch of legal links there that are primers. People can just, you know, get into the primer level there. We're not talking about going to Harvard Law School here. We're talking about your, you know, the basic grassroots, what you would call protections, that the mayors, the governors, police chiefs, you know, rotten coppers and all these other people are using to protect themselves and to you know, harangue everybody else. You know, you're not going to have those problems, even if it's neighbors or if it's the local cops or anybody else trying to give you a lot of trouble, you see, if you're empowered in these certain ways. So we're not talking about bringing down governments and waving red flags on a massive level where some of these people have, you know, abused these powers that I'm talking about. They've become paranoics, or they're parts of their militant groups or their militia, and they've even abused this, you see. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about an intelligent, rational, educated use of the legal powers that exist already in this world. That, let's just start there. You know, a lot of people might think, oh, that's just a baby step. I don't think so. I think it's a very important step for the average person to get very, very savvy on what is really going on and to help their own lives. Only when you've helped your own life, only when you're protected in your own self, only when your own finances, your own business, your own life is protected legally, can you hope to help anybody else out there, you see.
Mm-hmm. Yes, most definitely. We've got a caller on the line, and we're going to quickly grab them right fast as we are coming very quickly to the end of the show. I tell you, they just flew right by. So let's get this caller on. 772, what's your name and where are you from?
Hi, my name is Mandy. I'm from Florida.
Okay, hello, Mandy.
Hello. My question is, Mr. Sarian, what do you think will be the outcome, after 2012, now that the veil is lifting and people are being freed from this delusion? Do you see a positive result?
Jeremiah asked that earlier on. Mm-hmm. The way you're asking it, though, is not my concern. I'm not a person who looks to the future at all. I'm a person who looks only to what we have now. Many other people are not like that. Other scholars in the field could answer your question so much better than me. I am not a person who has any vision to look towards tomorrow's. It's just my personality. I'm not like that. I'm purely deconstructionist. I'm purely a person who sees the problem in front of me right now, sort of Alexander and his Gordian knot. You know, my issue is about how do you fix this Gordian knot problem now? You know, and tomorrow's are going to fix themselves. Tomorrow's will be there. Everything about the future is rooted in who we, you know, what we are now. So it's very, and also you must know by now, you must have studied human beings. They just love escapism. Human beings are pathologically into escapism. So you hand them any, you know, glowing future, Mandy, you know, and that's what I see in my work. So I have to be very careful with that, because when you're trying to teach people and you're trying to awaken them up to stuff, it's very easy for those people to start, you know, getting into hypotheticals. And it's okay to do that in your private life, to imagine and to think about what's going to come and to think about the age of Aquarius and all these other things. It's very important to think about that. But me as a teacher, you see, my hands are filthy pulling up the roots of the dirty weeds that are in the garden at the back. You know, I'm sweating from all pores, right? You know, my eyes are with tears of blood. Do you understand what I'm talking about? I am not interested in what's going to, I'm not interested in the rose gardens that are coming tomorrow. I'm out there in the mud, up to my eyes in it, and trying to weed the garden. Tomorrow's beautiful fragrance is maybe a bequeathment that will be for others to, you know, enjoy. My interest, my skill is in dealing with, you know, the breaking down and the destruction, sort of like a Ted Nugent in the world of, you know, metaphysics, if you will. Smash it down, get rid of it. Let's just destroy an old system. Let's get to grips with what is causing the pestilence, what's causing the corruption. You know, let's get into grips with what is causing. It's like a doctor looking at a bacteria or a virus that's infecting the body politic. He's trying to save the souls, you see, that are infected by something incredibly deadly. If you fix it, and if you strengthen people's immune system, and they do start to get well, hey, then tomorrow is already, you know, resolved. This is the important thing to remember.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Sarian. And
well, thank
I really
you,
appreciate
Thanks for your
all
question.
The work that you do. Thank you.
I appreciate you saying so.
All right. Thank you, Mandy. All right. Michael, if you'll give out your website again there for those listening. I also typed it in the chat room for those in the chat room as we are quickly coming to the end of the show.
Okay. Well, let me thank you first, and let me thank all the people who called in. The great questions. It's good feedback there. My website is michaeltesarian.com, but I also draw people's attention to the Architects of Control website, because we're releasing the DVD this very week and in the coming week. Architectsofcontrol.com, and also IrishOriginsOfCivilization.com. There'll be a DVD series that we're releasing within the next 10 days.
All right, and then your books and DVDs can be found on your website as well. They can purchase any through it.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
All the links are there, and also all to the free materials. We have trailers up for the Architects of Control.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a trailer yet for the Irish Origins, but we're going to be putting that up pretty soon too. You know, so we have a lot of free information. We did a live show with Red Ice Radio. People can go and check that out. And there's all the free interviews and all the free web streams,
mm-hmm.
all the free articles. And most of my books do not have the appendices in the book. It's only the first book on Atlantis that did. The other books, the appendices are online. And these are also collaborative pages in which information is sent to me from all around the world. I update those pages. So Irish Origins of Civilization.com. People can go to the appendices pages there to see very up-to-date information. Also, on the Atlantis book page, we have a free appendices section, a continued appendices section. And on the Astro Theology book, I'll probably be adding one there. But, you know, so there's a lot of free material by way of these websites that people come in and spend some time there, especially on the forum. We've got a lot of great links on the forum there, and we've got a page there that features all the latest media things that I'm doing, you know, interviews and web streams and so on.
All right, wonderful. And, you know, we still have tons of questions coming through, and unfortunately we're not going to have time to get them in. So is the forum a good place that they could go and sign up and post their questions and get some answers?
Oh, well, absolutely. It's free. And, you know, it's not just my answers then. It's a lot of other people collaborate.
Right.
And as I said, everything in my work is collaboration. You know, the forum is a place for people to send information, you know, and we put up people to post up their own experiences or put up DVDs. It's not DVDs, but put up links to different websites or, you know, other YouTubes. So, again, my work is one thing, but then there's a whole collaborative shell out there of people contributing incredible information. So we put those as links, and we also have a daily, you know. So people are absolutely welcome to come on there and tell us about themselves and their experience and also to share with us what, you know, turns them on right now.
All right. Well, good. Well, those out there who are listening, definitely go check out the forum, because I know you guys are still throwing a lot of questions out there.
I'm actually on that forum. I actually participate in my forum. There's a lot of other teachers out there that have forums, and they never own the damn things.
Right. Yeah, I know. We have a forum ourselves, and I take part in. As a matter of fact, I do all of our web design and everything. I know it's important to get in there and
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
You have to be personally involved. Otherwise, why have it, you know?
Right. Exactly. I definitely agree with you there. Well, Michael, it's just such a pleasure to have you on. And I tell you what, I've got one quick question here that maybe you can answer in just about a minute, maybe. Human lifespan, was it longer in the past? And that's from Hunka Hunka.
Well, it depends what age you're talking about. For most of the last 1,000 years, it was actually shorter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are exceptions. In the Far East, there are people who've lived much, much longer. But when you're talking about the industrial age or the agricultural age of the Western lands, people were basically, you know, not living past, you know, 25 was an average time of death. And even before, as I said, that doesn't mean that people didn't live longer lives. They did, but they were mostly the privileged and the upper classes. Lifespan was shorter. If you're talking about, you know, prehistorical times, well, your guess is as good as mine. In those particular eras, we believe that it was longer, that the people did live longer in the pre-industrial, you know, prehistorical periods. Lifespan may have been much longer than it is today, absolutely.
All right.
For instance, the electron count in the water, the very chemistry, the air we're breathing, is all much more deficient than it was in the past. The mineral count, you see, the electron count. So all of this has to be taken into, you know, consideration. But the toxicity that's in our environment right now also must be having a negative impact on life.
All right. Well, Michael, again, thank you so much. The website for those out there listening is www.michaeltessarion.com, T-S-A-R-I-O-N. Michael, it was such a pleasure. I appreciate you joining us tonight.
It was, and thank you again, Jeremiah, and thanks to everybody that called in. Really appreciate it. We'll do it again, huh, after a while.
Yeah, most definitely. We'd definitely love to have you back on, so we will, you know, look at doing that again in the near future. So, again, I appreciate it. All right, everyone. I appreciate everyone tuning in to Shadows in the Dark tonight, and especially thanks to our guest tonight, Michael Tessarion. And for all those who joined us in the chat room, I would love to give a roll call in the chat room, but I don't think I have enough time. There are so many in there tonight, and I appreciate that so much. Again, check out our website, www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com. You can sign up for our free newsletter, or you can sign up for our forum and take part in there, continue conversations about the show, or just anything else that's going on around the world. We definitely would love to have you there. Well, I appreciate everyone tuning in. Make sure to join us this Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern Time. We will be talking with Heidi Hollis about her latest book, Jesus is No Joke. So it's about her experience of with Jesus. So it should be an interesting conversation. So thanks, everyone, and we will see you next time. This has been Shadows in the Dark, and always remember to be watchful of those shadows in the dark.
Shadows in the dark.